Okay, so let's unpack this. We've been given some source material that, and I've got to say, it lays out one of the most sweeping, dramatic narratives we've seen in a long time.
It's really something else.
Yeah. We're talking about a history that it claims stretches back 1,400 years. It paints this picture of a massive, a seemingly unstoppable wave of systematic conquest.
Right, a force of nature.
And then, according to this text, it all comes to a screeching halt because of one tiny piece of land that just changes the entire direction of that force.
Yeah, and what we're looking at here, it's important for you to understand, this is a very specific prophetic interpretation of history.
Not a standard history book.
Not at all. It's framed entirely through the lenses of theology and, well, military metaphor. The source is a narrative. It's designed to convince you that these events in the Middle East, specifically around the conversion of ancient Christian lands, were all part of this long,
A
deliberate,
domino effect.
a domino effect, exactly.
Yeah.
And one that leads, in its view, inexorably toward a very specific future.
Our sources even give it these really evocative names, the story of the standing stone versus the long night of the falling dominoes. So our mission today, and this is critical, is not to validate the history itself, but to clearly and, descriptively explain the precise concepts, the language, the specific claims inside this text. We need to detail the mechanism of conquest it's outlining. And then we have to analyze the nature of this immovable object that it says halted everything. And then finally, we need to really dissect this predicted great reversal.
That's it, exactly. And the scope, the sheer scope, is what defines the argument. The source sets its timeline from the era when the Book of Acts was being written,
So the very beginning of the church.
the earliest centuries, right up to today. That huge span of time, 1,400 years, is so crucial because it's meant to establish this feeling of an inevitable, crushing force that was, in its view, divinely opposed. The authors want you to feel the weight of that history. So to get this, we absolutely have to grasp the core contrast it presents. The difference between, say, a peaceful, scholarly society and what the source calls a nation forged in the furnace of history.
Okay, that sets the stage powerfully. So let's start where the text starts, with the tragedy. Section one, part ein, the long night of the falling dominoes.
Right.
For you listening, if you only see the Middle East as it is now, where does this 1,400-year sequence, this systematic erasure, where does the source say it begins?
It begins at what it calls the absolute historical and spiritual center of the ancient Christian world. The sources describe the landscape as the very places where the core stories of early Christianity, the Book of Acts, were written and lived out.
So not some fringe area. This is the heartland.
The absolute heartland. For centuries, these were unambiguously lands of the cross. The sources established this foundation to really maximize the dramatic impact of what was lost. We're talking about the cradle of the faith.
And the authors, they paint a really vibrant picture. It's not just one city. They suggest this massive footprint, a whole network of cultures.
Yeah, they get very specific.
They do. They point out the historical reach, stretching from the mountains of Turkey to the libraries of Egypt. Before this long night began, the source claims the name of Jesus was the Song of the Land.
And that phrasing is important, Song of the Land. It implies a total societal saturation, not just, a minority religion, but the very fabric of the culture that was then systematically dismantled.
The emphasis on geography, then, that must be strategic.
Oh, absolutely. It's meant to show that the initial structure was vast and deep. I
Yeah.
mean, think about what's implied when it mentions the mountains of Turkey. That's Asia Minor, where you find the churches from the Book of Revelation,
Right.
and the libraries of Egypt. You're talking about Alexandria, the center of early Christian scholarship. So it's setting up the perfect victim, in a sense, a scholarly, spiritual, but ultimately militarily unprepared civilization.
So the conquest that follows is seen as more than just taking territory.
It's the systematic silencing of that song.
Okay, so that's the peaceful landscape. Then what defines the arising shadow and momentum? The text uses this almost metaphysical language, a shadow, a spirit of conquest, a militaristic storm.
And that framing is completely essential for the source's prophetic argument.
How so?
By calling it a spirit of conquest, the authors lift the conversation beyond just human conflict. They establish a persistent, unifying, and, in their view, malevolent motive behind centuries of geopolitical action.
So it's one spirit driving different empires over time.
That's the idea. And this force, the text really emphasizes, arose not with the message of choice, but with the weight of the sword. This distinction, conquest over persuasion, is key to defining the evil nature of the momentum in this worldview. It's the sheer weight, the inevitability of the military machine that drives everything.
And that weight of the sword is what kicks off the domino effect, which it calls a tragic and systematic erasure watched over 1,400 years. It sounds like the source is arguing these weren't just random wars.
No, not at all.
They were phases of a single, continuous strategic campaign. So I have to ask, how does the source justify calling it systematic? What's the proof in the text?
The systematic nature is proven, according to the source, by tracking the fall of major cultural and religious capitals in a very specific sequential order. Think about the flow of the narrative. The process began with the earliest conquests moving out from the Arabian Peninsula, and they struck right into these established centers. The source points to the incredibly rapid assimilation of lands like Syria and North Africa. These were territories with massive Christian populations, and they fell, in many cases, within a century of the first movements.
A century is nothing in this time frame.
It's a blink of an eye. Historically speaking, it was a sudden, violent transition that just dismantled ancient political and religious structures.
Which suggests a very calculated method. You go for the foundations, the cultural and governmental centers.
Precisely. And the long duration, the 1,400 years, is necessary because the process wasn't instantaneous everywhere. After that initial surge, the conquest continued through different dynasties, different empires, but it always maintained the same fundamental goal, the erasure of the ancient covenant.
Like the Ottomans.
The Ottomans are a perfect example. They continued the project, pushed deep into Europe, consistently using that same militaristic mechanism from the beginning. The source sees this continuity of purpose, even with different actors, as proof of that underlying spirit of conquest. Once it started, it just became self-sustaining.
And the source is very specific about who the victims were. This helps explain why the dominoes fell so effectively. It contrasts the conquerors, this militaristic storm, with the conquered.
Yes.
We're told the nations that were struck down were peaceful people, described as farmers, scholars, and believers.
This contrast is maybe the most profound sociological point the source makes about the failure of that ancient world. It depicts these societies as prioritizing, you know, introspection, theology, philosophy.
They're not military readiness.
Not at all. They were not looking for war. And crucially, they weren't built for the theater of war. In this narrative, their spiritual and academic priorities made them catastrophically vulnerable when they faced a force whose main, maybe singular, priority was conquest by force.
So the deep takeaway here is that their peaceful nature was actually their strategic vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
They were just unprepared. They weren't warring nations. What's the lesson the source is trying to teach with that?
The lesson is one of necessary resilience and active defense, and this is so important for understanding the standing stone metaphor later. The source argues that spiritual integrity on its own is not enough when you're faced with an existential threat.
I see.
It suggests that a tradition focused purely on scholarship and quiet devotion without developing the art of the watchman is basically destined to fall when a determined thief comes to the door.
And that's where the source connects this historical pattern directly to scripture, right?
Right.
And applies the warning from John 10.10. The erasure is framed through that lens. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy.
That's the rhetorical hammer. By citing that verse, the authors assign a very specific, profound, and, you know, an absolutely nefarious motive to the centuries of conquest.
It's not just about grabbing resources or land anymore.
No, it's presented as a spiritual mission of annihilation, a mission to steal the faith, kill the believers, and destroy the remnants of the ancient covenant. This elevates the whole conflict from geopolitics into this cosmic prophetic warfare. It gives you the why behind the relentless what.
And the result of this relentless push is definitive. The lights go out. The source gives this chilling sequential list of where the Christian light was systematically put out one by one. Damascus, Egypt, Asia Minor. Can we just pause for a second and detail the weight of those specific losses as the source sees them?
Yeah, we should. The loss of those three represents the almost total dismantling of the historical church structure. Damascus was New Antioch, a primary apostolic center where believers were first called Christians. Its fall meant losing a major intellectual and administrative capital. Egypt, the land of Alexandria. That was the home of Coptic tradition, of monasticism, of rigorous biblical scholarship. To subjugate that land meant stifling a massive ancient library of knowledge and piety.
And Asia Minor.
Asia Minor, modern Turkey, that was the core area of Paul's ministry. It was the base of the Byzantine Empire for 1,000 years. Its eventual erasure, culminating in the fall of Constantinople, represented the final collapse of the systematic, organized expression of the ancient faith in those lands.
So it's not just that people moved. It's the systematic removal of the foundational infrastructure of an entire civilization over centuries.
Exactly. The ultimate goal of this momentum, the source stresses, was total elimination, to keep the dominoes falling until every last trace of the ancient covenant was wiped off the face of the earth. And by the mid-20th century, that momentum seemed unstoppable. It had consumed huge tracts of land, silenced millions. The narrative is building to this climax where total victory for that conquering spirit seems inevitable.
But the relentless momentum, this 1,400-year-long chain of falling dominoes, had one final target left, a small, exposed piece of land that the source calls the apple of God's eye.
Mm-hmm.
And this final target brings us literally to the moment of collision, to the central metaphor of our whole deep dive.
And that connection is so structurally vital. The source implies that the failure of those peaceful nations was their lack of preparedness. So the story pivots here. What happens when this relentless momentum, successful for 1,400 years, finally runs into a people who are prepared?
Right. And that brings us to section two. Part two, the stone the builders rejected. This is the dramatic pivot in the entire narrative from the source material. After 1,400 years of successful momentum, victories across three continents, the shadow of conquest approaches what it thinks is the final, maybe the easiest, domino.
The tiny land of Israel.
Exactly.
And the text really highlights the profound overconfidence here. It was rooted in all that historical success. To surround this little patch of territory, it felt like the logical, easy, final step to complete the mission.
Just one more push.
Yeah. The thinking, as the source articulates it, was absolute. I have 1,400 years of momentum behind me. Nothing can stop this fall. The expectation was simple. A people who had been scattered and persecuted for centuries would just fold. They expected another domino, maybe even a weaker one.
That historical expectation only makes the moment of contact more jarring in the narrative. We're told the historical moment of reckoning is 1948.
Yes.
That 1,400-year momentum, this vast historical military force, slammed into a tiny patch of desert. Now, as an analyst, that's a remarkable, very specific claim. It ties 1948 to a 1,400-year prophetic cycle. Does the source acknowledge any other historical factors? You know, things outside of this spiritual conflict?
That's a great and necessary question. The source's framework is relentlessly focused on the prophetic interpretation. So external complexities, things like post-World War II, international diplomacy, or internal political movements, are all subordinate to the main narrative.
That's secondary.
They're secondary. For the author, 1948 is not just a political event. It is the prophetic collision point, where the momentum of the thief met the specific force designated by prophecy. It sees the geopolitical reestablishment of the state as just the external sign of an internal divine redirection.
And instead of a weak neighbor, instead of another falling piece, the source claims the momentum hit something fundamentally different, a living stone, the immovable rock, or the mountain.
The language shifts violently there, doesn't it?
It really does. It goes from these fragile, falling structures to solid geological permanence. It implies an elemental change in the physics of the conflict.
And that change in metaphor is the core intellectual transition of the narrative. The source uses this geological imagery to suggest that what emerged in 1948 wasn't a typical nation-state designed for peaceful life.
No.
It was an entity designed by history and prophecy for absolute resistance. It contrasts so sharply with the peaceful people from part one. A living stone is dynamic, an immovable rock is designed for impact.
Okay, we absolutely have to analyze the characteristics of this stone to understand why the outcome was so different. Why was Israel, the stone, distinct from the nations that fell before? The text doesn't say it was because of a bigger army or more resources. It comes down to character.
It's entirely attributed to character that's been forged by historical trial. The answer it gives is that this nation was birthed in the fire and had been forged in the furnace of history.
So the implication is that centuries of persecution, exile, the Holocaust, that wasn't random suffering.
In this narrative, no. It was a process of historical metallurgy, a deliberate, agonizing preparation that stripped away vulnerability and instilled this unique, unyielding resilience.
So they weren't just scholars and believers like the nations before them. They were forged into a different kind of entity.
Exactly. Their role, as the sources describe it, was being trained for battle. They possessed the art of the watchman and the skill of the warrior. This directly answers the failure of the ancient Christian lands.
So the stone was built for the theater of war.
Precisely because the historical context demanded it. The source suggests the stone's success was predetermined by its character, which was engineered for defensive survival against that 1400-year momentum. It's the required counterforce.
And this preparation leads to the dramatic halt. The source says the momentum didn't just slow down or get deflected, it shattered.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy it uses, a glass bottle hitting a granite rock, is incredibly vivid. It suggests a total instant stop to all that forward movement. How does the source connect that shattering to the idea of the spirit of conquest being broken?
The shattering implies a psychological and spiritual defeat, not just a tactical one. For 1400 years, that spirit of conquest operated with the certainty of inevitable success. The assumption was that every covenant-related entity was a predictable domino.
Right.
When it encountered the stone, that expectation, that 1400-year psychological certainty, was violently invalidated. The source argues that the force that hit the rock wasn't just defeated tactically in 1948. Its underlying momentum, its claim to historical inevitability, was destroyed.
And this idea of immovability has to be deeply rooted in the prophetic framework, which is why they bring in the scriptural backing for the stone stand, Zechariah 12.3.
This specific prophecy is the theological anchor for the entire defensive narrative. The text quotes it directly. I will make Jerusalem an immovable rock for all the nations. All who try to move it will be properly hurt.
That phrase, properly hurt, is very loaded in this context. How does the source interpret the ramifications of that hurt for the nations that tried and are still trying to move this rock?
The source interprets properly hurt very broadly. It applies it to any nation, political movement, or ideology that attempts to destroy or remove the stone. It sees persistent geopolitical instability, internal dissent, economic decline, military failures.
All of that.
All of it experienced by the stone's adversaries after 1948 as direct cumulative manifestations of this prophetic hurt. It argues that trying to continue the 1400-year momentum against the stone is the very definition of inviting ruin on yourself.
So the collision wasn't just a historical event. It was the establishment of a new defensive rule of physics in the region, one that's governed by prophecy.
That's a great way to put it. It mandates a critical change. For the first time in 14 centuries, the falling stopped AD. The systematic erasure, the domino effect, was not only halted, but through the active enforcement of Zechariah 12.3, the geopolitical risk of continuing that momentum became too high to sustain. And that conclusion sets the stage for the next, more active phase of the story.
Which brings us to section three, part three, the Great Reversal. Now we transition, moving past the defensive posture. We've established the immovability of the stone, but the narrative shifts dramatically here. It addresses what the sources call a limited perception, that some people think the stone is just there to block the way. I need you to unpack that shift. If the stone has successfully defended itself, why does the narrative insist it has to become an active agent?
It insists on it because the source material sees prophecy as dynamic, not static. Holding the line is only half the story. The ultimate goal, as it's defined in the source, isn't just survival, it's restoration.
Okay.
Defense prevents further loss, but to reverse 1400 years of loss, you need movement. The author uses this beautiful analogy, a stone doesn't just sit there. In God's hands, a stone can become a mountain.
And a mountain isn't just hard to move.
Exactly. It's a source of resources, a point of vantage, a place where new life can grow. The prophecy states the stone is about to move E, transforming from a barrier into a dynamic source of geopolitical change.
And this movement defines the current era, according to the text. It says we are entering the season of the pushback, or the hour of the great reversal. Let's define that concept precisely. What are the methodologies of this pushback? How does the source outline its geopolitical, spiritual, and military components?
The methodology is multifaceted. It has to be, to reflect the systematic nature of the original conquest. The pushback is explicitly defined as the active undoing of the domino effect. So, on the military and geopolitical level, the stone's active role is described as pushing back against the darkness.
What does that mean in practical terms?
It refers to projecting force and influence in a way that disrupts the stability of that long-standing shadow of conquest. It doesn't necessarily mean a traditional invasion, but more like strategic engagements, defensive interventions, undermining radical power structures.
And on the spiritual or social level?
On that level, the movement immediately creates an external effect. It's described as giving those people room to breathe again. This is the source's core mechanism for social restoration. As the conquering spiritual and political force recedes, it creates a vacuum, and that allows long-suppressed, non-radical, or ancient spiritual identities to start resurfacing.
So the stone acts like a geopolitical bellows. It's pushing oxygen into these suffocated lands, but it's not necessarily becoming a new conqueror itself. It's facilitating the self-determination of others.
Precisely. Restoration through facilitation. And the source details the stone, Israel, taking on this new dual role in the reversal process. It specifies that the stone is beginning to reach out, acting first as a shield for the oppressed.
So, military protection, humanitarian aid, sanctuary?
All of the above. Protection against the continued influence of the shadow.
And what's the second role? The text says it serves as a partner to those who thirst for liberty. That sounds less like military action and more like alliance building.
That's the economic and diplomatic dimension of the pushback. It suggests a recognition by certain regional powers or maybe emerging non-radical elements within those societies that the stone is a source of strength, stability, and technological partnership. So this reversal involves the stone using its new mountain status to build bridges, offering shared security, resource management, innovation, all of which ultimately weakens the historical grip of that 1400-year shadow. This partner role is key to understanding how the dominoes are prophesied to rise in the next section.
And once again, the source material grounds this act of restoration in prophecy, citing the vision from Isaiah 58.12. This seems to be the blueprint for the pushback's long-term goal.
It is the architectural plan for the Great Reversal. The quote describes the stone's actions. Your people will rebuild the ancient ruins and will raise up the age-old foundations. You will be called repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets with dwellings. This prophecy is interpreted by the source as a direct mandate to undo the systematic damage of the previous 14 centuries.
That title, Repairer of Broken Walls, is just tremendously significant, isn't it? It links directly back to the 1400 years of systematic erasure we talked about in part one. How does the source connect the broken walls of the ancient Christian lands to the actions of the Standing Stone today?
The connection is total. The source implies that the era of conquest systematically broke the societal, spiritual, and physical walls and wiped out the cultural foundations of those lands. When the stone is called a repairer, it suggests that its activity in the pushback era is designed to facilitate the rebuilding of those ancient, non-conquering indigenous identities.
So that could mean supporting minority populations or fostering cultural preservation?
Or enabling the safe return of displaced communities, yes. The rebuilding isn't necessarily done by the stone itself, but the stone acts as the shield and the partner that makes the indigenous rebuilding possible.
I see.
It's an act of restoration on a geopolitical and spiritual scale, restoring what was taken by the sword by providing the strength and security needed for the original inhabitants to flourish again. The source is arguing that the purpose of the stone is not just to stand, but to create the conditions for the revitalization of the entire region. This transition from passive defense in 1948 to active restorative engagement defines the current epoch in the source's view.
Which brings us to the final, almost unbelievable section. Section 4, Part 4, The Dominoes Rise Again. This presents the ultimate consequence of the pushback, the full reversal of that 1400-year trajectory. The source material claims this process is already underway. How does it even rationalize the ability of these deeply buried identities to suddenly resurface?
It relies on a very powerful a botanical metaphor here. It suggests that deep under the soil of those fallen nations, the ancient Christian seeds and spiritual roots planted by the apostles, the foundations we mentioned in part I, are still there.
So they were buried but not destroyed.
Exactly. They were dormant. And now, under the protective influence of the stone's pushback, they begin to stir. The erasure was not just incomplete. The vital core remained, just waiting for the darkness to recede and allow sunlight back in.
That implies a hidden history that persisted through that whole long night. But this stirring isn't just a private spiritual thing, is it? The text says it has a clear social and political face. It identifies two specific groups that will participate in this rising.
It does.
Who are they, and why are they finding their voice now?
The first group are the underground believers. These are the individuals who kept their ancient covenant beliefs in secret, often facing intense persecution or social isolation. As the stone provides a shield for the oppressed, the geopolitical pressure lessens, and these hidden communities start to feel safe enough to come into the light, reclaiming their public space.
And the second group.
The second and much broader group are the non-radical souls. these are the vast majority of ordinary citizens. The people who just want peace, stability, normalcy, who previously kept quiet or were forced into submission by the shadow. Now, because that dark influence is receding, these people will find their voice again.
So the source argues that the true political and spiritual potential of the region isn't radical conquest.
No, it argues the true potential is peaceful, ancient pluralism, which is now reemerging under the protection of the stone.
That sounds like a societal normalization that's being achieved through external security. The source then gets really explicit, noting specific nations predicted to rise again. Egypt, Lebanon, and the believers in the East. These are the very nations from Part I whose lights were extinguished. Why single out Egypt and Lebanon?
The focus on them is crucial because they represent two different facets of the historical erasure. Egypt, home of the Coptic Church, represents one of the oldest and largest indigenous Christian communities that actually managed to survive the 1400 years, even under intense pressure.
Right.
So its rising again implies a revitalization, a return to prominence and influence, shaking off the weight of that shadow.
And Lebanon.
Lebanon, on the other hand, historically represented a fragile attempt at coexistence that eventually just collapsed under internal conflicts, which were made worse by external pressure. Its rising again implies the restoration of its unique, delicate, pluralistic structure, allowing the Maronite and other indigenous Christian groups to regain their footing as true partners in the land.
And the believers in the East is just a broader category.
Exactly. It signals restoration across the entire geographical scope defined back in Part 1, from Turkey to Iraq.
It effectively reiterates the core mechanism of the reversal one last time. What the sword took by force, the stone is restoring by strength. It's an active, spiritual, and military undoing of history.
That sentence is the thesis statement of the entire source text. The sword represents the mechanism of conquest and forced erasure. The stone represents the mechanism of restoration and liberation. The source is crystal clear. The ultimate battle is not over who controls territory, but over which mechanism forceful erasure or restorative strength will ultimately define the future of the Middle East.
And finally, the narrative comes full circle. It anchors this ultimate restoration, the full rebuilding of what was systematically broken, in a third and final scriptural foundation, Amos 9.11. This has to be the final word in the source's argument.
It is the final declaration of victory for this narrative arc. Amos 9.11 is interpreted here as the comprehensive promise of repair. A prophetic assurance that everything lost will be reclaimed and renewed. The source quotes the conclusion. In that day, I will restore David's fallen shelter. I will repair its broken walls and restore its ruins, and will rebuild it as it used to be.
The phrase rebuild it as it used to be perfectly mirrors the systematic destruction we dissected in section one. It suggests not a new creation, but the restoration of the original ancient covenant lands.
Precisely. The authors use this to emphasize that the story ends not with continued conquest or stagnation, but with total comprehensive restoration. The Middle East, according to this text, is not doomed to permanent darkness or conflict. It is being actively prepared for a divine awakening led by the stone that would not move.
And that awakening means the reemergence of those ancient identities, cultures, and spiritual expressions that were silenced.
That's the vision.
So the narrative arc is complete. What started as this tragic story of falling dominoes, driven by a 1400-year momentum of conquest, is ending as a triumphant story of rising. The era of the falling domino is over, and the era of the standing stone, the active repairer and restorer, has begun. That is an incredibly detailed and specific framework for understanding regional conflict. Okay, so we have spent a good bit of time dissecting this source material. It's so dense with prophetic and historical metaphor. To quickly synthesize for you, the listener, we track the 1400-year historical timeline of conquest that the source says wiped out the ancient lands of the cross.
Mm-hmm.
We analyze the significance of the 1948 collision point where that momentum of the shadow was finally and violently shattered by the stone forged in the furnace. And we examine the shift from immovable defense to active reversal, defining the current era as the pushback.
And crucially, we detailed the three major prophetic anchors that support this entire framework. You have Zechariah 12.3, which establishes the immovability of the rock and the resulting hurt to its adversaries. Then Isaiah 58.12, defining the stone's active role as the repairer of broken walls, tasked with facilitating the reversal of historical erasure.
And the final piece.
And finally, Amos 9.1 on, promising the full, complete restoration of the ancient ruins as they used to be. The source really does provide a comprehensive three-part cycle of history, collision, and renewal.
Given the depth of this explanation, especially about the nations mentioned like Egypt and Lebanon, it's clear this source is offering a very precise theological interpretation of current geopolitical events and even the formation of new regional alliances.
What's fascinating here is that the narrative suggests you, the listener, aren't just observing random chaos, but that you are currently watching the map be redrawn, not by the falling of the weak, but by the rising of the brave, enabled by the presence of the stone. And this perspective forces a really important question. If we accept, purely for analytical purposes, that this narrative of restoration and pushback is accurate, how should one interpret recent geopolitical shifts and emerging alliances in the region, especially those between the stone and its historical neighbors, alliances that seem to actively challenge and dismantle those 1,400-year-old power structures? It asks you to view today's headlines not as momentary struggles, but as specific chapters in a long, deliberate, prophetic reversal.
That is a compelling and a very provocative lens through which to view current events. Thank you for sharing this intensely detailed material with us and allowing us to take this deep dive into the tale of the Unstoppable Stone.